Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the concerns expressed by political strategists and pundits that following the first two debates, the Democratic presidential candidates on the ascendancy are taking the party too far to the left, as the centrists like Joe Biden appear to flounder, while others like Governor Bullock of Montana were not able to make it onto the crowded stage. We will speak with an economic advisor to Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell Law School, who helped Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and Ocasio-Cortez write the Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act. He joins us to discuss whether the Democrats are committing political suicide by ignoring the center of the party and pandering to the left, with former Governor Hickenlooper and former Congressman Delaney advocating for more centrist policies, and Joe Biden being run over by Kamala Harris to the point many are writing him off as roadkill. We'll assess whether the dream ticket of Harris and Buttigieg, Liberal Democrats are envisioning, will fly in flyover country. If Joe Biden, who has always had a solid lead in the polls, has lost his mojo and a Biden-Harris ticket is no longer viable, then where is the opening for Elizabeth Warren, who appears to be gaining popularity at Bernie Sanders' expense? Then we'll examine further the bold move Elizabeth Warren has taken by pointing out that the private health insurance industry are the wrong people to be providing health care, since their business model is to make as much money as possible from premiums and pay out as little as possible for health care. Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent for The Week, where his latest article is "The Democratic Debates Had a Healthcare Problem," joins us to discuss the existential threat Elizabeth Warren poses to the powerful insurance lobby with an overflowing war chest that will be deployed against Warren to prevent the American people from learning how the rest of the advanced countries deliver healthcare to their people without the unnecessary and parasitic layer of the middlemen of big insurance. Then finally, with President Trump having had a 50-minute meet and greet with Kim Jong-un on the DMZ with a brief excursion into North Korea, we will speak with Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and author of The Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World. He joins us to discuss how Trump admitted the brief meeting was about him and Kim looking good. And since Jared and Ivanka were featured in photo ops at the G20 and Ivanka sat across the negotiating table from Xi Jinping, we will assess whether this Trump family-centered diplomacy is a way around the U.S. government, allowing the Trumps and Kushners to make deals with dictators and possibly make some money on the side. And joining us now is Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions, a fellow of the Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, and the Occupy Cooperative. And he's a member of a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. He recently helped Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and is currently a public finance advisor to Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and helped write the new Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Hockett.
Hi, Ian. Great to be with you again.
Well, thanks, Robert. And I'm talking to you because I think you're the best person I can find who works for both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. To answer this question that the pundits are posing after these two debates, particularly the second debate, if you read the piece by Brett Stevens in the New York Times, a wretched start for Democrats. The party seems mm-hmm. interested in helping everyone except the voters it needs. And then it goes mm-hmm. on, it shows the picture of all 10 Democrats, presidential candidates taking part in Thursday debate, raising their hands to indicate that they will provide Medicaid benefits for illegal immigrants. And of course, several of them, in fact, spoke Spanish, even though I think the audience was largely English, which struck some people as pandering. And of course, Brett Stevens says he has this sort of snarky piece of Spanish and translated, "Democratic friends, if you go on like this, you're going to lose the elections and you'll deserve it." So do you think that the move to the left of what seems to be the ascendant Democratic candidates is a suicide pact?
No, I don't. And I think that the characterization that people like Stevens and others are making of things is sort of absurd. The real problem, I think, at bottom is sort of lumping Bernie and Liz together with the others, right? I think Bernie and Liz are actually a very different kind of political person or very different kind of political personality. And you didn't see them sort of trying to burnish their multilingual credentials or whatever in these so-called debates, which I think are probably better thought of as soundbite contests. You saw them actually trying the best they could to talk serious policy, even when given only 30 to 60 seconds to address questions, which, of course, is a complete and utter joke. If they had had more time actually to talk about what they believe in and what they want to do, I think it would emerge very quickly that Bernie and Liz really are at the center of American politics, and the others are either nowhere or they're way to the right. You know, basically everything in the platform of Bernie and Liz is supported by 70% or close to 70% of the American population. It's all been polled this again and again, and it's very easy to substantiate this. So Bernie and Liz are really at the center. I think of Bernie at the current center, right? I think of Bernie as a kind of an FDR Democrat and of Liz as a kind of Eisenhower Republican, and there's not that much space between those two, but there's all the space in the world between those two on the one hand and all of the others on the other hand.
But I know I'm going to talk to this about this to the second guest today on today's program, but my sense is that since Elizabeth Warren sort of raised a sort of existential threat to the insurance business by basically telling the American people in a way that they really need to be educated, that, look, you know, the private health insurance is they're the wrong people to be in the health business. They make money out of premiums and they lose money out of health care. So they want to take as much money as out, have you pay as much money in premiums and give you as least amount of money back in terms of your claims and your health care. That is a fact. And the rest of the world has figured out ways around this. So they're going to deploy so much money against her. It's just, you know, if you think that they they shot down Clinton and his wife's health care plan with Harry and Louise, yeah. You remember that? Well,
yeah, 93, yeah.
There you go. Multiply that by 1,000, and that's what's going to happen to Elizabeth Warren.
Well, what I think is that the other eight, I guess, is that what it was? No, I mean, I guess we're really talking about the other 18. The other 18 folk seem to be basically pinning their hopes on that, right? I think that's basically why the other 18 people are in the race or were on the debate stage, right? I think that essentially they all recognize that there is at least one possible vulnerability that both Sanders and Warren face precisely in virtue of the fact that they are the only ones actually taking on big pharma, big insurance, big banking, big finance, and so forth. And so I think they're pinning their hopes on maybe being able to edge themselves in as the sort of fallback candidates in the event that Bernie or Liz turns out, or Bernie and Liz turn out to be unviable as a result of the kind of opposition that they elicit from big money interests. That being said, Bernie did amazingly well back in 2016, notwithstanding the fact that he was very much that so-called existential threat to lots of these interests. And now there are, of course, two such threats in Sanders and Warren, and they both seem to be getting an awful lot of traction. So I wouldn't bet against them and in favor of the large moneyed interests. I would probably vote the opposite, particularly in light of the polling data.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions, a fellow of the Century Foundation. He does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, and the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislatures and local governments. He recently helped Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and is currently a public finance advisor to Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and helped write the Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act. But all of the candidates, not only they put their hand up to say that they would be in favor of Medicaid being extended to undocumented immigrants, but they also all were in favor of Medicare for all, I think, with the exception, of course, of Delaney and Hickenlooper. I don't know, did Joe Biden... I don't know what he's against, Ryan.
I think he raised his hand as well in that second debate. I think they all actually raised their hands in that debate. And I think what's going on here is that candidates are either exploiting an ambiguity or are unaware of an ambiguity. The good faith ones are unaware of it. The less good faith ones are exploiting it. The ambiguity is this. One understanding of Medicare for All is such that you could have it as essentially something available to everybody, but without any actual prohibition of private insurance. So it'd essentially be making Medicare into a kind of public option. The other possibility, of course, is to say, well, actually, Medicare for All will not be viable unless we prohibit private insurance. And there's thus far, the punditry has not distinguished between those two possibilities. Bernie has. He's made very clear, you know, in the legislation that he's introduced that there would be effectively an end to private insurance, that it would be prohibited as a competitor to Medicare and Medicaid. But others have not, right? And so what happens is it's very easy to say, I'm in favor of Medicare for All, as long as it hasn't been clarified whether or not that means prohibiting private insurance. If you do make clear that you're also talking about prohibiting private insurance, you get a little bit less popular support. And so my guess is that some of the candidates are trying to avoid losing that support by declaring against private insurance at the same time that they declare for Medicare for All as an option.
So at the risk of sounding like a political version of a Hollywood casting agent, what about this idea that I've been reading about, the dream ticket of Harris and Buttigieg, which liberals are envisioning? It does seem to me and to many, I think, that Joe Biden's lost his mojo. And this is pretty early on. So if he sort of fades, you know, a lot of people were suggesting, and of course this is terribly early, and the polls are sort of meaningless at this early stage. But the feeling was, well, you know, Biden has got such a big lead in the polls and he needs a woman. And he's got, you know, Elizabeth Warren. I mean, he's got Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris. She not only is she a woman, she's in the minority as well. So that's been the assumption. But if Biden fades, which he appears to be doing, then what's left? And what's the place for Elizabeth Warren if you know, everybody sort of jumps on this idea of Harris and Buttigieg being the dream ticket?
Mm-hmm. So I guess three quick things, right? The first is I think there's no doubt that Biden will be out of this race very soon. And I'm one of a fairly small number of people, I think, who's been saying that since last April. Anybody who's actually watched Biden with any closeness will realize or has realized right away that he's really entering into a kind of, I think, early stage loss of cognitive function. I think this is one reason he's had so very few public events. I think his handlers are terrified. I think he's basically the Jeb Bush or the Ben Carson of the Democrats this year. And that's been clear to me and to a number of other people, I think, since April. So all that Kamala Harris did was to sort of prove the point or to sort of punctuate the point. So that then opens the question as to what the dream ticket is. I have a view on this. I think there's a kind of a golden ticket, and then I think there's a kind of a silver ticket. And Harris and Buttigieg are not among the gold or the silver. I think they're silver. I think they're kind of a sick joke, actually, as a dream ticket. I think the dream ticket is Sanders and Warren for a very straightforward reason, and that is that both of them tap into the sort of energy of the precariat and of the youth, by which I mean basically everybody under 50, who all overwhelmingly support Bernie as distinguished from somebody like Clinton. And at the same time, Warren basically, I think, attracts enough of the old Clinton holdovers as to give us a kind of a twofer, where we basically get the Bernie base of support on the one hand and enough Clintonites to put them over the top. So I think that's the golden ticket. Silver, for me, I think would be if, for whatever reason, Bernie decided that he wasn't going to stay in the race or whatever, not that that's going to happen, but if it, for whatever reason, were to happen, I think a more likely ticket would be something like Warren and Castro, partly because Castro, I think, is a little bit closer to being a true Warrenite than is Mayor Pete, God bless him, and partly because, again, you get a little bit of additional diversity out of him as well, which could help. And he's himself a solid sort of Clinton leftover. So, you know, you'd still get a lot of Clintonites in there. So Liz, I think, would pick up a bunch of the Bernie votes if Bernie were in the race. And Castro, I think, would pick up the remainder of the Clinton votes, any that Warren didn't already independently attract. And so I think that would be a much more likely ticket to form and to win. And it wouldn't be a bad presidency or administration either, although I think, again, a Sanders-Warren administration would be the ideal.
And what do you think? I mean, you suggested that Joe Biden is sort of entering Ronald Reagan territory in Reagan's second term. But I think he's being obstinate about not. I mean, he was given an incredibly easy opening to say, you know, when he was asked about the Anita Hill debacle, he was given an opening to sort of say, yeah, I got it wrong. But he didn't. And the same thing, you know, and I think Harris sort of ambushed him in a way. You know, she obviously was very prepared. She had that prepared remark about this, not, you know, not being a food fight. Let's put, should be about putting food on the table. And she clearly had was prepared to ambush him, and he seemed like a deer in the headlights. But he, again, I think Joe Biden really honestly feels like he's done a great job, and he's got a great record, and he just simply doesn't want to answer these questions and take the easy way out, which would be to apologize or to say, you know, I got it wrong. I mean, Mayor Pete apologized over the shooting and the fracas in South Bend between the African American community and the cops. So, what do you think? I mean, I don't want to diagnose somebody. You know, I'm not a doctor. You're not a doctor. We don't know what's going on in Biden's head. But just in terms of his resistance to take the easy way out and say, yeah, I got a couple of things wrong, but I've otherwise had a pretty stellar career.
Well, there's sort of two things, I guess, I would say about that. So the first is that, in a way, Biden is kind of the worst possible option, right? I mean, if you think in terms of ideals, right, you would have somebody who is, let's say, very principled, right, very devoted to principle, and hence, you know, not willing too easily or cavalierly to compromise those principles, even if it looks like they might not be as popular as one might wish. That is one possibility. Another, of course, is to hold principles, but to hold them very lightly and thus be willing to kind of compromise them or surrender them if it turns out that a large number of people are against them. And then the third possibility is to have no principles and yet still be obstinate or still be stubborn, just about insisting that what you did in the past was right, even if it's not tenable and even if it's not defensible. And Biden seems to be that person. In other words, the principle, quote unquote, that he holds fast to is just, if I did it, it was not wrong. But as far as the actual sort of principles that might have motivated those earlier decisions are concerned, it's not really clear what those principles would be, other than pro-segregation principles or anti-busing principles or you know, pro-anti-social security principles or what. I think the clearest sign that there's something really strange about Biden was, you know, when it turned out that he had phoned Anita Hill to quote unquote apologize just about a week before he announced, even though it had been 28 or 29 years. And then even the apology he ends up, or the pseudo apology or cynical ersatz apology, he blows by making it a kind of sorry, not sorry. It's one of those sorry I offended you or sorry that you were offended type apologies, which everybody knows is no apology at all. So, I mean, I think that's the sort of the first thing to say about Biden. The second thing is, yeah, I think you and I, of course, are not doctors. Nobody can sort of diagnose him. We can only call them as we see them. But what we see anytime he does speak in public is absolutely no energy at all and constant stumbling and kind of muddling through what he's trying to say and difficulty finding words and so forth. And so it does seem that at the very least, he's not especially prompted or motivated by any sort of principle to which one can kind of passionately adhere, or that if he is, he just doesn't have the physical wherewithal to sort of stand behind it, right? So he just seems to be, you know, in a way, one of these people who feels sort of entitled to the office. I think George Will once referred to this as the presidency as gold watch, right? He's done everything else on the resume, just like George H.W. Bush had done circa 1988, and just as Hillary Clinton had done, of course, circa 2016, and thinks, well, you know, what would be a fitting capstone to this wonderful career of public service of mine? Well, the presidency would be. That should be my gold watch. That should be my retirement gift. And surely I'm entitled to this, and I don't actually have to be answerable to the public or to those who object to earlier stances that I took that were way out of sync with the way public morality works now.
Well, just in closing, the reason the Democrats control the House is because they're able to elect a bunch of centrist Democrats, or at least running in purple and red districts. So if that is the reality, then how are Liberals going to move the needle to bring in more centrist Democrats and disillusioned Republicans? Or do you think that, as Bernie thinks, that if you can get the young people to vote and if you can get 70% of the Democratic electorate voting, then it'll be a landslide?
So, again, I really think that Senator Sanders and Warren and Representative Ocasio-Cortez and much of her cohort that were elected this past November are the new center, right? So the real question, I think, is how do you keep some of the right-wing Democrats? And I think, you know, if you think about it, it seems like there are two pretty easy ways to do this, right? One is to make clear what your actual message is, which is, in fact, something supported by the overwhelming majority of the American public. If we sort of get away from the slogans or the sort of tag words and just talk about the actual substance of the policy. And the second, of course, is to point to Donald Trump and say, that's not moderate. Right? So I think, and that's another reason why, again, I think a kind of a Sanders-Warren ticket with a view to it maybe flipping down the pike a bit, maybe 4 or 8 years hence, into a Warren-Sanders ticket, so you get a kind of effective co-presidency for, you know, 12 to 16 years. I think that's the ideal way to go, because that way you do keep the kind of Clinton-type Democrats at the same time that you capitalize on the great energy of the new center, which is the center that's given us by those who are under 50.
Well, Robert Hockett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. Always wonderful.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions, a fellow of the Century Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund and Americans for Financial Reform and the Occupy Cooperative. And he recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act, and is currently a public finance advisor to Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and helped write the Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into, following the Democratic debates, whether the candidates have a health care problem. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent at The Week. His works appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And his latest article at The Week is "The First Democratic Debate Was a Circus, and the Democratic Debates Had a Healthcare Problem." Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Ryan. And I want to obviously talk to you about the healthcare problem that you see, and how would you define it? Since Elizabeth Warren in the first debate really took on the health insurance business, there were pretty much the centrist Democrats ended up as roadkill: Hickenlooper, Delaney, and Joe Biden. What's your sense then of why the Democrats have a healthcare problem?
Well, I guess the biggest part of this is that it's really escaping the kind of discussion just how bad the problem is. We spend 5 percentage points of GDP more on our healthcare than the next most expensive country, which is Switzerland. And, relative to our economy, that's $1 trillion every year. And if you look at the outcomes, our outcomes are, okay in certain areas, pretty good in a few narrow ones, but generally it's pretty bad. Life expectancy has declined for three straight years. You know, it's unprecedented since the First World War. And so that $1 trillion is basically going right down the toilet. And so when you hear these, you know, these moderates saying like, well, we don't, you know, we need to preserve choice. We need to, you know, not upset the apple cart too much. It's like the apple cart is sort of, you know, careening off a cliff. And, you know, the penny ante kind of little nibbling around the edges is not going to deal with things. But conversely, on the other hand, you know, it was nice to see Warren coming out strong for Medicare for all. But, you know, the something progressives don't like to hear that much is that the insurance companies are not the only villains here. You know, the providers are also a big problem. Not all of them, but a lot of them. You know, you look at doctors, especially specialists, make much, much more money in the United States than they do in peer nations. And, you know, there are a lot of hospitals that basically operate like stick-up rackets. You know, they try to get uninsured people into their who've had some emergency into their out-of-network, you know, system, and then just soak them for every penny they can get. And so, you know, that's a major problem. And you know, the whole kind of private insurance system is kind of falling apart piece by piece. It's getting more and more and more expensive with every passing year. I think the healthcare coverage for the total cost of that for a family of four was on average $28,000 last year. And that's just, you know, getting out of reach for so many people who have insurance, but, you know, it's effectively not really doing much for them unless they happen to, you know, have some sort of really terrible emergency. And so, you know, I think that it's hard to do a debate like this, but I think that the urgency of the problem really wasn't coming across.
Well, I was just talking to our previous guest, who's an economic advisor to Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez, about the Bret Stephens article in the New York Times of where he's castigating the Democrats and captured the photograph of all the people on the stage putting their hands up, saying that they're all in favor of giving Medicaid to undocumented immigrants. The reality is that the healthcare of the last resort in this country are emergency rooms, and you're just saying how hospitals, you know, gouge you. Well, if you go to a hospital for emergency, they have to treat you because it's the law. But on the other hand, you get stuck with a massive bill. That is the sort of healthcare of a last resort. There's no question to my mind that Elizabeth Warren is pointing out something that needs to be pointed out, which is that the private health insurance, these big insurance companies are an unnecessary and parasitic layer, and they don't bring anything to the table. That they make their money by getting as much money as possible from premiums and pay out as little as possible for healthcare. So you couldn't have a worse bunch of people. But the way that it's being discussed is, it's like Medicare for all or nothing, when you would think that they could have at least framed it better by referring to it as a public option. You know, in Australia and Canada, the UK, all the countries that have single payer, they also have, the citizen also has a choice of private insurance. If you know, want to in the UK, you can go to the Harley Street specialists. So I think that none of those candidates who are in favor of Medicare for all seem to point that out. And that's where the insurance lobby that has so much money, and they're going to just spend more money than they've ever spent destroying Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, I can bet on that, that they haven't really, I don't think, have presented this argument in the framework of a public option as opposed to Medicare for all.
Yeah, well, it's difficult in terms of, you know, your tactical positioning, right? Because, you know, you look at the composition of the Senate, you know, even if Democrats get a majority, it's going to be, in 2020 that is, it's going to be small. You know, your swing vote's going to be like Joe Manchin, if you're lucky. And like getting Medicare for all through that, that's almost impossible to imagine. And so then you start thinking about, you know, okay, what could we get passed? And it seems like the smart move in that context is to, you know, just aim high. Here's our bid. And, you know, when it gets time to actually make the law, as opposed to, you know, being on the campaign, you know, you sort of start there and you negotiate with the other folks and see what you can get through. And that's why Bernie is, I believe, voted for the Affordable Care Act, because that was the best you could get in that particular moment. And it would help things here and there. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to the kind of public option thing, I mean, if I recall correctly, in Canada, there is private insurance largely because their Medicare system does not cover prescription drugs or dentistry or vision. And so there's a lot of employers have perks just like in the U.S., but solely for those sort of things, is kind of supplemental coverage. And in fact, Justin Trudeau, I believe, is working up a sort of pharmacare benefit package, possibly in response to Bernie. You know, they would be very humiliated to see a Medicare that's better than Canadian Medicare go through. But, you know, whether it's necessary for Sanders to, you know, in his bill, which would ban private insurance from offering coverage which duplicates Medicare, I'm not sure I see why that's necessary, because they would almost certainly be outcompeted by Medicare anyways. And so that might be a sort of tactical risk that is kind of unnecessary. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think the important thing is to keep the bid high and to emphasize the utter dysfunction of the current system. And then hopefully, you know, after 2020, there's a Democratic president and Democratic majorities, and you could sort of work something out that's as good as possible, given this broken party that you have to work with.
And again, I'm speaking with Ryan Cooper, who's a national correspondent at The Week. His works appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And Ryan's latest articles at The Week are The First Democratic Debate Was a Circus and The Democratic Debates Had a Healthcare Problem. Let's turn to the first one, the first debate, which you're referring to, I imagine, in The First Democratic Debate Was a Circus. The second one also, the circus had not left town, unfortunately. I actually just simply got annoyed with so many of these people on the stage. Swalwell, Hickenlooper, Delaney, Yang, Marianne Williamson. It's like, what are you people doing? You know, and they have to take shots at other people to get noticed. And they were just annoying. They were like some, you know, eager kid in the back of the room that's showing off to the teacher by putting the hand up.
Yeah. I mean, it's the qualification certainly was ludicrously low, 1%. You know, I think if they increased the qualification to 2% in the polls, it would have 9 total. And so they could have had, you know, 5 in 1 and 4 in the other. You know, the most compelling part of the second debate was when, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were going hammer and tongs, and then it's just two people and they're talking about a specific policy. And I would have liked to see another, you know, 20 minutes on that, because there's a lot of history there. And, you know, the policy desegregation still very important in 2019. But when you have so many candidates and like 3/4 of them are total nobodies who are not going to win with 99.9% probability, it's just like a complete waste of time. You know, if you had a smaller core, maybe you could say we're going to do 4 people in the main debate, and then we'll have like 10 in the other and see if anybody stands out. But then, you know, have, instead of, as they did, flitting from topic to topic to topic, like 5 different things in 2 hours, you could have 2 topics and really dig in, you know. And you know, if, as long as I'm talking utopian hypotheticals, you could have a moderator who knows what they're talking about instead of Chuck Todd. You know, it's just
yeah, he's definitely there in the annoying category, that's for sure. Ryan, I talked to a professor emeritus of journalism at Northeastern recently, who wrote a book on U.S. Presidential debates, 50 years of presidential debates, and he's obviously studied the subject. And I asked him, well, what what model could you follow? Who has the best political debates? And he said the French do, that they basically do what you're just saying, only two or three candidates or maybe four. The moderators just introduce them and then they stay right out of it. And the candidates just go at it each other and get into depth about, you know, a limited number of issues. And so how do we get to that as quickly as possible without these kind of circuses that we've seen for the last 2 days?
Well, that's, I mean, you know, replace the entire cable news industry. That'd be a good start. But maybe, I don't know, realistically, given that, you know, CNN isn't going anywhere, these people should drop out, at least half of them. You know, the Andrew Yang, you know, the Hickenlooper, Michael Bennett, the guy from Colorado, he made a point during the debate that, oh, we have to win the Senate and keep the House in addition to winning the presidency. So I say, you are currently a senator. You're not going to win. What are you doing, buddy? Like, get back in there and campaign for whoever's running against Cory Gardner, the Republican senator in Colorado who's up in 2020. So, you know, at least hopefully you see the field consolidate and a lot of these people start running out of money. And, you know, the whole pipe dream thing just goes away. But, you know, that there's hardly any way that outsiders could affect that at all. You just hope that in a few months it would at least be down to, say, 10, which is still too many, but would be less of a mess.
So do you think... you mentioned, and everybody, of course, noticed it became the headline in the second debate, the Kamala Harris going after Biden. Do you think that was the breakout moment that everybody's talking about? Do you see her as the front runner, even though it's awfully early?
Well, I wouldn't say she's the front runner, but I did see most recent polls as of like yesterday. Harris gained like 6 points or something like that. And so she and Warren are tied just behind Bernie. And then Biden lost like 5 points. He's down to like 30% or something like that. I would say she unquestionably turned in the best performance of either debate. She clearly, you know, had really practiced. And, you know, I guess the prosecutor is pretty good at speaking in front of crowds. And that moment, you know, she both had the policy right that you know, desegregation to integrate the schools to sort of eradicate the legacy of Jim Crow was good, and Biden was on the wrong side of that, and he flagrantly lied about his actual history, and at the same time, she has the credibility both as a black woman and someone who was bussed herself as part of an integration project back in the day, and. So that was just, you know, Biden, what you could see it coming, and you could see that he just didn't have any shot at convincingly refuting that because he doesn't have a leg to stand on, frankly. And front runner, maybe not, you know, there's not a lot of love for prosecutors these days among the Democratic base, but I would say she's definitely in the top tier, the top like 4 to 5 candidates, and I reckon she'll probably stay there if that debate was as any indication.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, do you a lot of liberals see the dream ticket as Harris and Buttigieg? What do you think of that?
Oh man, I mean I'm not a particular fan of Harris, but at least she has some national experience. The prospect of Buttigieg in any capacity, he's what, like 36, 37? He worked as a McKinsey consultant, like one of the worst companies in the, you know, entire world. And his major political experience is being a mayor of a city with 100,000 people. You know, I think the whole qualifications thing can be taken too far. You know, it's not like you need to be some sort of, a 30-year veteran of national politics to be a good president, but I think that it's a good idea to have some. And Buttigieg, he seems just way more slick than he is actually intelligent, and has, more importantly, has correct analysis of what the problems are. So I think that would just be a ridiculous development. You know, far better to have, you know, if Harris is going to be in there, Warren, you know, would I think be a far better and a much more logical, you know, pair, whichever one, you know, ends up on top.
But, so an all-woman ticket, you know, an all-woman ticket. You think that, I mean, you know, she's a black woman and a gay guy, that doesn't make it with you, but two women would, right? In Trump's America. Because I think Trump is, by the way, just in the closing here, Trump is on a roll. He did incredibly well in his press conference at the G20. I mean, he's starting to improve. I think he's going to be harder to beat. He's not this floundering idiot that we've seen for the last 2 years. He's starting to sort of get his stride. If he can pull off a deal with the Chinese, even though he created the problem, but if he can turn around and solve it and get his Nobel Prize for having a love affair with Kim Jong-un, whatever, I wouldn't count out Trump. I think he's going to actually get harder to beat as opposed to easier to beat.
Yeah, I mean, the economy is doing well, and he's an incumbent, and that means he can win. You know, you definitely couldn't write him off. That was the mistake in 2016. But I also think that just about any of these candidates would have a pretty solid shot. You know, liberals absolutely hate Trump, and, you know, most of them are not at least drooling idiots. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to come down to who can win the primary. And then from there, you know, it's kind of anybody's game.
Well, Ryan Cooper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Cooper, who is the national correspondent at The Week. His work has appeared in The Washington Monthly and The New Republic and The Washington Post. And his latest article at The Week is, his articles at The Week are, The First Democratic Debate Was a Circus and The Democratic Debates Had a Healthcare Problem. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the meet and greet President Trump had with Kim Jong-un on the DMZ and Trump's brief excursion into North Korea. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, The Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, and his latest book is The Koreas Now in a Second Edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Charles. And what did you make of this 50-minute photo op, meet and greet on the DMZ, where Trump stepped into North Korea for a little bit? And the one thing that he said in his photo op, which was pretty amazing and sort of disarmingly honest, was he essentially said, you know, this is all about me looking good and you looking good, Kim, you know, because if you wouldn't have shown up, the press would have piled on and I would have been embarrassed. So I find it extraordinary that Trump admitted that this was all about him and Kim Jong-un looking good.
Well, it must not ever be forgotten that Trump's main experience coming to the White House is being the host of a reality TV show. And in a way, he seems to see his role still as that. And appearances are really extremely important for him. The meeting took some of us somewhat by surprise. It's not clear how far in advance this had been planned. It wasn't exactly spur of the moment, but it was something that Trump apparently decided to do at the suggestion of South Korean President Moon Jae-in and had been thinking about for a while before going to Korea, but probably only was finally decided fairly recently. And it was quite an impressive spectacle. I think it's a bit more than a photo op, in as much as the two apparently discussed restarting talks between the two governments and opening the door for another summit meeting that hopefully this time would be more substantive and have a positive outcome than the failed summit in Hanoi earlier this year.
Well, the first two guests in today's program, one's an economic advisor to both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the Ryan Cooper has written fairly critical articles of the Democratic centrists on the stage who, in these two debates, who ended up being roadkill along with Joe Biden. The point I tried to make was that, you know, you can't underestimate Donald Trump. They did it in 2016. Hillary Clinton did it. And if you followed Trump's press conference after the G20, which went on for about an hour and a half, he's handling himself so much better. He seems to be actually coming into his stride. He's not the bumbling amateur and embarrassment that he's been up until now. And as you say, this thing on the DMZ was more than a photo op. Do you think he's going to be a lot tougher to beat in 2020 if he pulls off this deal with the Chinese, even though he created the problem over tariffs? He can turn around and solve it. I don't think he's going to get his Nobel Prize for Peace with Kim Jong-un because Kim's not going to give up his nuclear weapons. But maybe he can get something out of it. So what do you think of that possibility, that Trump is actually much tougher to beat?
I also doubt he'll get a Nobel Prize, but the Korean situation or solving the problem with North Korea has been Trump's centerpiece in foreign policy, or the one aspect of his foreign policy that he's tried repeatedly to show as his great foreign policy success ever since he came into office. And he's done some things that have been genuinely progressive for moving the parties away from war. Of course, he started the war of words that almost led to military confrontation in the first place. And so this is, in a certain way, part of a pattern of Trump creating a problem and then taking credit for solving it. But he's also claiming credit for solving the China trade problem, which is also objectively exaggerated. But nevertheless, to the extent that foreign policy will be important in the presidential election, and usually it's not that important for U.S. presidential elections, Trump will point to some successes as well as, of course, significant failures.
Well, when I called you earlier today, you mentioned that you think that it was Barack Obama in his White House meeting with Trump in the transition that has led to Trump's singular focus on North Korea almost at the expense of every other theater. He wants to get out of the Middle East. He trashes NATO. He gives our allies the back of the hand. He tears up treaties and deals like the TPP and the Paris Climate Accords and the P5 plus one. But he certainly seems to, North Korea seems to be the jewel in his crown.
Well, Trump seems to have had an obsession with doing the opposite of everything that Obama had done. So whether it's on climate change or healthcare, the Iran nuclear deal or North Korea. So Obama negotiated a deal with Iran, which Trump promptly scuttled upon coming into office. And it seems that the Obama people informed Trump that North Korea would be his toughest foreign policy challenge, and that seems to have actually spurred Trump on to focusing on addressing this issue that no previous U.S. president had been able to solve. Now, whether he can solve it either, whether he's going about it the right way, and whether his administration really has the manpower, the patience, and the vision to truly resolve this problem, of course, remains to be seen. But it can't be said that Trump has ignored the North Korea issue at all, and indeed he has taken some really unprecedented steps in dealing directly face-to-face with the North Korean leader, which at the end of the day, I believe, is the only way, if this problem is to be solved, it can be solved. The North Korean system is very much a leadership-driven one. Policy decisions are made at the very top, particularly decisions as important as relations with North Korea or the nuclear program. And Trump seems to have, for whatever reason, an instinctual understanding that dealing directly with Kim Jong-un is the only way that the problem can be solved.
So, obviously, the Nobel Prize is a long way off, and I don't see Kim giving up his nuclear weapons, and that's why the Hanoi talks collapsed. But, you know, you've suggested that something might happen, and I've suggested that Trump is, you know, based upon his press conference at the end of the G20, he seems to be more confident and in his presidency, making him, I think, more difficult to beat. But the one thing that's glaring about this trip to the G20 and to the Koreans and to the DMZ is the family business. You know, it's unbelievable. You've got Kushner and Ivanka, Jared, they're taking photo ops with Abe at the G20, and you know, you look at the pictures of the meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping. There's Ivanka on opposite Xi Jinping at the negotiating table. You know, what are they doing? I mean, you know, this is just extraordinary. That the Trump diplomacy is a family affair, and I think in many ways, and by the way, of all people, Stephen Bannon is the one that came up with this idea or this analysis that what's happened here is that as soon as the family got in power, Jared Kushner put up the shingle and told all the dictators around the world, you don't have to deal with the American government, you can deal directly with me and my father-in-law. And if you look at what happened at the G20, Trump is chummy with the murderous MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, with Xi Jinping, with Turkish dictator, et cetera. It's no question that something's going on here. And a lot of people think that maybe at the end of the day, when they're out of office, they're going to get a massive windfall into their real estate businesses by the Saudi sovereign wealth fund.
Well, in a way, maybe one reason that North Korea and the Trump administration are coming together is because they're both family businesses. In a certain way, they understand each other. The Trump administration, in general, not just in foreign policy, as is well known, is a kind of family regime. In the case of the Korean situation, I wouldn't think there's a lot of money to be made, unlike what many have said about the Trump extended family and the Middle East. Although potentially there are some economic benefits, and as Trump keeps saying, if North Korea opens up, and I've said only semi-facetiously that if Trump really wants to get North Korea to give up nuclear weapons, he should offer to open a Trump hotel in Pyongyang. It is quite extraordinary. I mean, there are two aspects of what Trump is doing in the world that are quite remarkable, as many people have noted. One is his strange orientation toward authoritarian strongmen and how he seems to really genuinely respect and get along with them as opposed to our traditional liberal democratic allies. And the other is, as you say, the close involvement of the Trump family, including son-in-law Jared Kushner, in the foreign policy. And this is something we've never seen in U.S. politics before, but which is common for many other less democratic countries. It is something new in American politics, that's for sure.
Well, you know, Tillerson, the first Secretary of State, who got, rather shabbily treated by Trump, he had some closed-door testimony recently before the House Foreign Relations Committee, and it's been leaked out. And he's basically says that he was undercut at every turn by Kushner. And in fact, he went out to dinner at a fancy restaurant in Washington, D.C., and ran into Kushner and the Mexican foreign minister huddled in the corner, and the Mexican foreign minister's face went ashen. He was so embarrassed. And Tillerson said, well, next time you're in town, let me know. Basically saying he was completely undercut by this. And, you know, Kushner's got the so-called Middle East peace deal of a century, and you know, he's going to build condos on the Gaza Strip. Good luck with that. You know, I know you're right. I don't think you can have condos on the beaches, although Trump talks about all this beachfront property in North Korea. It's a surreal world, isn't it? I mean, have you ever seen anything like it?
It's a strange way to run a foreign policy, and not a very efficient one. You know, the thing that is troubling about the future of U.S. North Korea talks is that it's one thing to have a photo op and to have a summit meeting. It's another to really do the difficult work of diplomacy that can hammer out an agreement that will stick, that will really resolve the nuclear problem, that will move the Korean Peninsula away from the situation of conflict and bring the U.S. and North Korea into a less hostile, more normal relationship, and eventually open up North Korea to the world. That's difficult, even if you have the best of personnel and the most strategic leadership in the White House. But clearly we don't. We have a kind of government by tweet that lurches from one crisis to another, a highly depleted State Department, and a real shortage of personnel, and an administration which seems to undercut the professional foreign service and the State Department kind of willy-nilly. So we'll see if we can really make any progress under these conditions. It seems doubtful, but we can always have some hope.
Well, Charles Armstrong, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who is a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, and Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World. And his latest book is The Koreas, now out in a second edition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Ricky Herrera. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for iTunes, etc. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.